And we're back here on Unusual Sources here on CFMU 93.3 FM, broadcasting to Hamilton and to the rest of the world also via our internet broadcast, which you can access at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. And we should be speaking with Tom Reed, an organizer with the November 9 Committee to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal. There's a big event coming up, and we want to talk about that and issues surrounding the case. Hi, Tom, can you hear me?
Certainly.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, we got you. It worked on the first try. That's excellent. I'm so pleased to, you know, I just got this in my email a few days ago, and, you know, I was just mentioning, I was talking to people at the station and saying, hey, it looks like I'm going to be interviewing someone about the Free Mumia campaign, and they said, oh, I haven't heard about that in a while, and certainly that's been the issue in Hamilton. I don't think it's been talked about much recently, and, you know, I wanted to go over that. There's a few things we got to look at to what's happening in this case, and I understand Mumia is in special danger right now, and basically, I guess the big issue here is that there's going to be a rally, and like you say, there's the November 9 committee, so there is a November 9 event, and that's Tuesday, November 9 at 6 p.m. at the U.S. Consulate in Toronto. So that's 360 University Avenue between Dundas Street and Queen Street. If you've been involved in any demos, you're probably familiar with the U.S. Consulate in Toronto, so there will be a demonstration on that, and we have a situation where I guess you have someone being called a political prisoner, you have irregularities in the trial, and so forth. Could you tell us about Mumia Abu-Jamal, just how he ended up in this situation, where he comes from in terms of his background as an activist?
Sure. Well, he was, when he was 15 years old, he joined the Black Panther Party. And Mumia is a very talented and intelligent person and rose very quickly in the Panther organization. He was soon writing for the newspaper. He was made the Minister of Information of the Philadelphia branch where he grew up. And he was involved in a good deal of Panther activity. In the course of that, he was among many of the Panthers. The FBI ran quite an intensive attempt to disrupt and break up the left in general, and the Panthers in particular. Was called the COINTELPRO program, counterintelligence. Mumia, apparently, his file was something like 700 pages of spying on him. Kinds of documents that the FBI have assembled. When the Panthers dissolved, Mumia took up a career as a radical journalist, and he won several awards in Philadelphia. He was very popular, particularly with the black population, because he was very critical of police brutality. The Philadelphia police have a long history of really very intensive brutality and a great deal of corruption. Those things often go together. And his journalism made him suspect in the eyes of the police and the authorities in the city, and many of them considered him to be an enemy of the state. In December of 1981, Mumia was, to supplement his earnings as a radical journalist, he was driving a cab and happened to be downtown in sort of the seedy nightlife area of Philadelphia at 4 a.m., where a police officer named Daniel Faulkner was shot. And Mumia came upon the scene. His brother happened to be present also. And Mumia ended up being shot as well. And that circumstance of him being in the wrong time, at the wrong time in the wrong place, led him to be charged with the crime of killing a police officer. There are a lot of there's a lot of interesting background involved in the killing of Daniel Faulkner. It's highly probable. There are a lot of indications that he, in fact, was one of the non-corrupt officers who was cooperating with the FBI and federal authorities in investigating corruption in the Philadelphia police force. There were three separate federal investigations going on of the Philadelphia police in the early 1980s, and they ultimately resulted in convicting 30 police officers, including the assistant commissioner of police, the captain who was in charge of the downtown division where Faulkner worked and where he was killed, and also the highest-ranking officer at the scene who was charged initially with the investigation. So the motive was thought to be that there was a cooperation between, there was a kind of payoff racket where the police would get paid off by the mob who was running prostitution and gambling and after-hours clubs and things like that. And the police were aware that the feds were investigating and were seeking to seal up leaks. Faulkner had, for example, in his possession a CopCon camera, which was a very expensive camera of a sort that the FBI routinely used in its investigations in that period, and yet it was a very unusual camera for anyone not involved in that to have in his possession. So the Mumia, the killing was not designed to fit Mumia, but he was fit to the killing. And before long, the police came up with several witnesses, two of whom claimed to have seen Mumia pull the trigger on the police officer. One of them, named Robert Chilbert, was a cab driver who was had his license suspended for various reasons and was susceptible to pressure. He later admitted to a private investigator that he, in fact, hadn't seen what he said he'd saw. And another was Cynthia White, who was a prostitute who had a lot of convictions outstanding with the police, had been arrested for prostitution and related charges 38 times in a year and a half before the shooting, and after Mumia's conviction, was never arrested again, and yet was able to practice her trade unmolested by the police. And she told several other prostitutes who she worked with and people that she knew that she had been coerced into saying what she said and that she hadn't in fact seen anything.
So we have a case where I guess you have a couple of perhaps unreliable witnesses in this case, and you have a motive for the killing of this officer that is consistent with groups other than Mumia Abu-Jamal. Now, you're suggesting that the case was made to fit Abu-Jamal, or perhaps Abu-Jamal was made to fit the case. And I guess you'd have to do some jury rigging to do that. I've heard about irregularities in the trial. You have the situation with the witnesses. Now, there's the confessions. I'm told there's a confession from the actual killer. There's other evidence from the crime scene that would suggest Mumia's innocence. So is there even more to this trial?
Yeah, there's quite a bit more. The judge who was given the trial, his name was Judge Sabo, and he was known as a hanging judge. He apparently had sent more people to death than any other judge in the United States. He also apparently had the highest rate of reversals on his convictions of any judge who would, this is estimated by Amnesty International. Something that some of your listeners might want to look up is Amnesty International did a report called A Life in the Balance in February 2000. They didn't come to a position on what happened, but they did a very careful study of a lot of circumstances and details around the case, and it's a useful study, I think. It's got a lot of useful information in it. One of the obvious problems with the way that the prosecution was carried out was that the jury was screened to screen out blacks. Philadelphia was a city with something like 40% of the population black at that point, and yet Mumia got a jury with 10 out of 12 jurors white. The prosecution had 15 peremptory challenges where they can eliminate potential jurors for no reason, and they used 11 of those 15 to eliminate blacks. This is a consistent pattern, and of course it's not how it's supposed to function. It's actually technically illegal, but it was used against Mumia. His lawyers have sought to appeal this and to point this out several points, and it's been dismissed. Another aspect of the case that's significant is that Judge Sabo, one of the court stenographers, a woman named Terry Maurer Carter, came forward almost 20 years later in 2001 and said that at the time of the trial, she had heard the judge in his chambers say, yeah, I'm going to help them fry the N-word in reference to Mumia.
I see.
So that's the kind of justice he was getting. In 1999, as you alluded to, an individual named Arnold Beverly, who had a career as a hitman for the Philadelphia mob, came forward and talking to some of Mumia's investigators and confessed that he had, in fact, been hired by the mob to carry out the hit in cooperation with the corrupt police officers, and that he was prepared to testify to that in court. One of the interesting things about this case is that Beverly also said that he himself was winged by a bullet. He and another guy that he knew were involved in the shooting. Who shot Beverly is unclear. But one thing that is clear and is in the record is that there were three blood samples taken at the site. One belonged to Mumia, who was shot by arriving police. One belonged to Daniel Faulkner, the police officer who was killed. And the third one was unidentified. And it's believed that the third one belongs to Arnold Beverly. One of the reasons that they will not depose him, will not allow his confession to be heard, is that the DNA testing on the third blood swab, should it turn out to correspond to Beverly's blood type, would of course tend to validate his confession, and the powers that be would not get the result that they want, which is to execute Mumia. The reason that we're calling this an emergency protest is that there is a hearing in Philadelphia on November the 9th, the day of the protest, where a decision will be made. Arguments are made orally by lawyers on both sides, and the judges will at some point after that make a decision. But what's at stake is the question of whether he should be executed immediately or given a new sentencing trial. A new sentencing trial would allow certain amounts of evidence to be introduced that have been excluded so far, but would not be the question of Mumia being released would not be posed, just the question of whether or not he'd be sentenced to death or a lengthy prison term, presumably life.
Well, it sounds like there's irregularities you want to address in whatever fashion. And, of course, again, for those that are just tuning in, we're speaking with Tom Reed. He's an organizer with the November 9 Committee to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal, and they are organizing a demonstration here in Toronto area as well. So that is happening once again in Toronto on the 9th at the U.S. Consulate, which is 360 University Avenue at 6 o'clock p.m. So the 9th at 6 o'clock p.m. there. So I guess there's a couple of things I'd want to look at there. Number one, as you said, given these irregularities, in some ways, it could be argued that he's been targeted for this purpose of putting him in prison on death row, and he's being called a political prisoner. I know he has contributed a lot to social justice activism, anti-war activism in the United States, having been highly politicized and an activist before the trial, before 1981. He continued to do so. He was very consistent in that regard. I'm especially interested in some of the anti-war things he's done. We can get into that. But in terms of the event that's happening on the 9th, given the choice that the courts face, what are you hoping, I guess, in which direction are you hoping to push things in terms of how the legal process can move or how there can be public advocacy in that case?
Well, Mumia's life is at stake in a very immediate sense. His lawyer, Robert Bryan, has said that he is now, in quote, he's now in the greatest danger since his 1981 arrest, danger, that is, of immediate execution. On two separate occasions in the past, Mumia has had a death warrant signed in his case, in 1995 and again in 1999. And on both occasions, particularly in 1995, there was an explosion of very sizable demonstrations and a lot of publicity. A lot of well-known people got involved in Rage Against the Machine, put on a concert in defense of Mumia. Ed Asner came out in defense of Mumia. A lot of prominent figures, and most importantly, there was a groundswell of ordinary working people, of youth, of Afro-Americans, and people who identify with the plight of the underdog, and people who particularly do appreciate a lot of the work that Mumia has done, as you mentioned. One of the really outstanding events in Mumia's defense, which is pretty much blocked out of the media, but was actually very significant, I think, was that in 1999, dockers in the International Longshore Warehouse Union shut down every port on the west coast of the United States, that is from San Diego up to Bellingham, Washington. Every port was shut for the Saturday, April 24th, 1999, which happens to be Mumia's birthday, in solidarity with him.
You know, it's serious when you've got the dockers on your side. I know they've taken part in some anti-war activism. They had been blocking certain packages related to wars or conflicts overseas. So, it's very interesting to see that. Certainly, it seems that at any demonstration in the United States, you're going to see Free Mumia signs. It's an issue that has electrified people constantly and through a wide geographical area as well.
I should mention that the demonstration that's taking place in Toronto is taking place in conjunction with demonstrations in many parts of the world. We're in touch with people who are organizing similar events in New Zealand, in San Francisco and Oakland, in Philadelphia, of course, which is probably the largest one, in New York City, in Paris, in Hamburg, in London, England, and many other places, we believe. So it has been very important in the past that the powers that be understand that the whole world is watching. And if people look into the details in this case, they can see in a rather condensed form how in the what sometimes describes itself as the greatest democracy in the world, how the results of the impartial justice system, as it's described, are often predetermined and biased against, particularly against black people, but also against people who stand up for the underdog. And that's really Mumia's crime. That's why we consider him to be a political prisoner.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can see in terms of Toronto, that's our opportunity for people in Ontario to participate. We can be part of that Tuesday, November 9 demonstration. So I guess that's what we would encourage people to do. And you mentioned the death penalty, and certainly, you know, the United States government is very quick to criticize executions abroad in many cases, and yet they conduct executions of innocent people, mentally handicapped people, political prisoners could happen. And this is something that if we're activists, if we're anti-war, if we're for social justice and human rights, we should be out there saying, stop the execution of Mumia Abu-Jamal. I want to play, if I may, just briefly. I know he has been sending out many tapes. I know as a journalist, he's been continuing to contribute to movements. And there's so many issues he touches upon. He takes on not just the wars that are unpopular, but also the wars that are less known. So he's a critic of the war on terror, of the war in Iraq, but he was also a critic of President Clinton's bombings of Sudan and Iraq. So he has a consistent worldview about what U.S. hegemony can mean, and he's someone who very aware of works and other authors in that field, Noam Chomsky, others. And he's very consistent on this basis. I'm going to see if I can play.
I just like to add that Mumia is, as you say, quite an internationalist, and therefore he's very critical of Canada's role in Afghanistan as well,
yes,
as we should all be.
Yes, absolutely.
It's not just the Americans that get up to bad things.
Oh, well, don't think I'm covering for us. The first half of this program was about the upcoming George Galloway tour in Canada.
Right.
His tour is called Free Afghanistan, Free Palestine, and he's going to be speaking specifically about the Canadian government's attempt to ban him from the country for trying to speak out against the war in Afghanistan. So that's happening November 21st here in Hamilton. So absolutely, we're well aware of our government's complicity in imperial endeavors abroad. What I'm going to attempt is to play a segment of one of Mumia's tapes, and that one concerns Iran. It's from 2007, and it's as fresh today as it was when he played it, when he wrote it. So I'm going to play that. We're going to see how relevant this is. Stay on the line. Let's see if we can get this to work here.
Sure.
Iran, rumors of war? Question mark. There are forces in this country and in this world that are expending prodigious amounts of energy to ensure war with Iran. That's right. I said Iran. Many of those forces were the same ones that suckered the nation into Iraq with media megaphoned fear-mongering. Iran has become the feared boogeyman of the hour, the latest in the simplistic media projection of bad guy. And just as in Iraq, the media's demonization of the leader becomes reason to destroy, attack, bomb, occupy a nation. He's a bad guy. He's a ruthless dictator. Doesn't this sound familiar? Has the nation learned nothing from the Iraq debacle? Famed linguist and scholar Noam Chomsky, interviewed recently by radio host David Barsamian, gives a powerful example of the impact of media. Chomsky noted, take a classic example, Germany. Under the Weimar Republic, Germany was the most civilized country in the world, the leader in the sciences and the arts. Within 2 or 3 years, it had been turned into a country of raving maniacs by extensive propaganda, which, incidentally, was explicitly borrowed from Anglo-American commercial propaganda.
So that's a segment right there from Mumia, and that's, again, that's 3 years old, but it's as relevant today as it was when it was recorded. Now, Tom,
I think that gives your listeners a good idea of how powerful Mumia is. You've got to remember that this is a guy who's locked in a cell, gets out 1 hour a day to see the outside world a little bit, is not allowed to have a computer, has very limited, restricted access to the world outside him, and yet has continued to pay careful attention and write very intelligent commentaries on a wide range of subjects.
Well, as you said, he is in a prison cell, and he's able to keep up with international affairs, I guess, better than 95-99% of Americans. So it's commendable that with limited access to information and freedom in the outside world, he's able to really write and speak in such a way that remains relevant over a period of years. So he stands the test of time in many of the statements he makes, in the way he opposes wars, in his consistent analysis of U.S. policy, Canadian policy, and so forth. I guess one thing regarding that broadcast, I believe you're probably familiar with the website of the people that help record and distribute Mumia's broadcast. Could you tell us just where we could look for that?
The website that I go to, that I consult frequently, is www.mumialegal.org. That is mostly concerned with the legal developments in the case, but there are links from that that go to many others, and I don't have offhand, I can't think of what the website is you're referring to.
I have the production credits at the end, so we're going to play that at the end, but just want to point people towards some sources.
Yes.
Again, that's going to be Tuesday, November 9th at 6 o'clock p.m. in the U.S. Consulate at 360 University Avenue, and this is the Free Mumia Abolish the Racist Death Penalty demonstration to stop the execution of Mumia Abu-Jamal. It is in conjunction with a series of demonstrations being held across North America and across the world to protest the possible execution and stay on death row of this, what's being called a political prisoner. And again, we can find information through a number of sources. The email contact address is NOV9MUMIA. So that's November 9, NOV9MUMIA @gmail.com. So that's one way to get in touch. But we can see these people, everyone that's involved, on Tuesday, November 9 at 6 p.m. Tom, I want to thank you so much for bringing this to our attention. Again, this is an issue that we need to be refreshed upon here in Hamilton, and you have the detail that you've been able to provide for us. And there's a few radio stations and other sources that are picking up this story. We're getting a few emails circulated around, but it's time to really help Canadians get involved and recall this situation. So I'd like to thank you for taking not only the time to be on this interview, but taking your time to organize on this basis and help people in Canada be part of this issue.
Well, thank you for helping get the word out, and we look forward to seeing some of sisters and brothers from Hamilton down at the demonstration on a week.
Certainly.
We're Tuesday, gonna, actually, next Tuesday.
Yes, it's not long from now, yeah. So we better be quick in getting the word out.
Right. Well, thanks a lot for your help.
Oh, no problem. Thank you once again, Tom.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Tom Reed, and he is an organizer with the November 9 Committee to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal. We're just about to finish for today, but what I want to see if I can do is go back to where Mumia was giving commentary on Noam Chomsky. Let's finish up what Mumia has to say here, the production credit. That'll be how we end our program for today, with his hopefully not too prophetic analysis of U.S. foreign policy.
Explicitly borrowed from Anglo-American commercial propaganda. And it worked. It frightened Germans. They thought they were defending themselves against the Jews, against the Bolsheviks. And you know what happened next. That's from the book Targeting Iran by David Barsamian. And speaking of brutal, ruthless dictators, the U.S.-backed Shah of Iran used his secret police, the Savak, to drench the earth with blood and terror. But he was cool to Americans. The U.S. Senate recently passed a non-binding resolution supporting the partition of Iraq. It makes a certain diabolical sense. The U.S. bombed it, invaded it, overthrew its government, and replaced it with puppets of their liking. All this, not now being successful, why not shatter the nation into threes? This argument is now being made not by rabid neocons, but by so-called liberal Democrats. Why? Because imperialism is a truly bipartisan American project. The newest target may well be Iran, despite the fact that if Iran is indeed more influential today, it's because of the U.S. invasion, occupation, and near destruction of Iraq. Iran was strengthened by Iraq's fall. The U.S. has a Middle East policy driven by fear and ignorance. It is reactive, emotional, and driven by faith, not reason. Those are dangerous forces to justify war. and unworthy of a nation that considers itself a superpower. Super in power, but petty in reasoning. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.